Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, friends, to Behind the Byline, the radio show that takes you behind the scenes of Carolina Public Press's investigative journalism. In journalism, a byline is the line of the article that states the name of the author. The title of this show, Behind the Byline, refers to the process of uncovering how the author's background, experiences, and perspectives influence their writing. This phrase offers readers a glimpse into the writer's motivations and expertise and increases their understanding of the article. I'm your host, Lindsay Wilson, and today we'll be playing a recorded interview with freelance reporter Jack Engelman about his work covering environmental stories in North Carolina, from the coast to the mountains and everything in between. Jack has written numerous articles for Carolina Public Press over the years about environmental topics impacting communities in every corner of the state. He recently reported on a pending lawsuit filed by conservation groups on behalf of several endangered bat species in western North Carolina, and has also been closely following an unfolding story about the Mountain Mist Mine in McDowell County. From his home in Asheville, Jack keeps an eye on issues related to the environment and climate across the state of North Carolina, and he has a real knack for explaining dense topics to a general audience.
All right, we're delighted to have you on the show today. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. I've come through our archives, and you've been working with Carolina Public Press for quite some time. Do you remember some of your early environmental stories for our newsroom?
Oh, my gosh. That's a great, great question, because it's been about a decade.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, some of the first ones were on the forest plan
wow.
in, like, 2014. That when that process started, we jumped on it. So those are, yeah, I'd have to think back in my archives in my brain.
Yeah, that's amazing that you've come full circle. 10 years later, still reporting on the same topic. But
no, I've made a career out of it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, someone has to.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it sounds like this is a topic that you've been passionate about for quite some time. I'm wondering what sparked your interest in environmental issues, and particularly how those issues relate to public policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, having for many years just have been someone who enjoys being outdoors and worked in the outdoors for a while as an Outward Bound instructor, so became really connected to this area in particular and the natural resources here, you know, the mountains, the rivers, the rock, the trails. So, you know, when I started writing, a lot of the early writing that I did was about the outdoors, and so it's always been a natural fit. I'm a little less interested in writing, you know, I guess I'd say travel stories about, you know, here are these cool resources that you could come visit.
Mm-hmm.
I like writing about the policy. I like thinking about how we manage these really, really complex resources. That is really what I'm interested in. Rather than being a travel writer, I'm interested in really diving into the complexities of, you know, whether it's the complexity of the science of our forests and our resources, or whether it's the complexity of the policy. Those are, I guess, are slightly different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a real joy to report on an area that I care so much about. And obviously so many readers and people around here are, you know, we're just so, our lives are so connected to the resources here. That's a cool thing about Asheville, as it is about other communities
mm-hmm.
around the country. But I think it's obviously so important to our tourism economy, to how people recreate, to just our view shed, what we're looking at, the quality of our water. So the beer that we get is dependent on how we maintain our forests and all that stuff. So we're really, I love it how Asheville, how Western North Carolina and the state in general, all the way from the coast, is really connected to our natural resources.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, speaking on that theme of complexity, I just think that sometimes your reporting is on these really deeply complex issues, like the Pisgah Forest Plan, for example. So how do you make sure that you don't miss the forest for the trees?
Oh, yeah. And that's been hard. I think one thing that's been really great is the opportunity to write about it for such a long period of time, because that also gave me the ability to better understand the nuance of the issues and to continually get to better understand all of the deeply complicated relationships between, you know, whether it's the science or the economic aspects of the forest. So it was great to be able to drag that out, you know, over that period of time, because it's really hard to explain some of these things in 1,000 words or 2,000 words. So it was great to be able to continually dive in to the forest plan and to dive into various aspects and tangents of the forest plan, like how it affects small communities, for example, or how it affects hunters, or how it affects all the different aspects and all the different stakeholders that are connected to the forest.
Yeah. I love talking about the Pisgah plan in particular, because I think it would be really easy to get lost in the weeds with some of these stories. You know,
yeah.
There is such complexity and so much nuance. But I think one thing that you do particularly well is crafting a narrative and finding the voices of really strong sources. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you source for these stories.
Yeah. One great way it was early on going to many of the meetings, many of the public meetings, and beginning to see, you know, who is showing up and beginning to connect with those people. And so it was being a reporter for such a long period of time on this forest plan, I really got to know the various experts. So if I, you know, knew a story involving birds, for example, well, I would know who to call. So over time, you know, which is true for any kind of beat, is you begin to develop your sources, and you know, it really helps too. I think a lot of the people that I interviewed would trust me as well. I didn't always get the facts right. You know, I made mistakes. I didn't always get, you know, cut the quotes that they would have liked me to say. But I built up trust over that period of time. And so that really helped sources open up more. And then, of course, you know, the last question I always ask of every interview is, like, who else should I talk to about this? And that opened up a whole new array of people to talk to and figure out. And there were many, what is extraordinary about the forest plan is just how many people stayed involved with the forest plan. Many of them work for organizations that, you know, that is their job, to be involved with the forest plan and to advocate. But there were also many, many volunteers, people who spent their own time as a volunteer advocating for something. And that was great. You know, it wasn't, there were some rotating a cast of characters coming in and out, but there were many of the same people involved, and that really helped in sourcing information and people to interview for this.
Yeah, that's great insight. I love that, asking at the end of interviews who else to talk to. I think that that's something I've learned to do in community organizing circles.
Yeah.
But that's just a fantastic tip for other reporters
out
there. Yeah. You've reported on everything from coastal fisheries to ghost forests. And most recently, you uncovered a story about protecting several endangered bat species in the forests of Western North Carolina. With so many super fascinating topics to choose from, how do you pick which stories to investigate?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one, I'm trying to look and see if I find a topic that feels interesting to me. One of the first things that I do is find out who else is reporting on it, you know, or what aspects of this story hasn't been reported on, and also does it scale? You know, sometimes a story might have a very localized aspect to it, but it might involve an experience of people living in our state that scales. Other people are having a similar experience. And so I'm always looking for, you know, maybe a universal nature of a story. And, you know, I think I'm looking for stories in places that tend to be either, that tend to be underreported, you know, either because they're in a rural area, or maybe they involve a marginalized community. So those are some of the things that really interest me. But I'm also interested in any story that involves climate change, stories that involve public land, and stories that involve, you know, that really get to the heart of the environment of North Carolina, whether it's on the coast, Piedmont, or up here in the mountains. Tend to report more on the mountains because that's where, you know, we are, where I am. But I love reporting on the coast, and just we have a great state, so it's a fun, plenty of stories to uncover.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're pitching a story for CPP or another publication, what factors do you consider? You've kind of touched on this already, but are you most interested in like policy decisions or human impact or drawing attention to non-human species?
Yeah, I know. That's a great question. I think what's always interested me in stories is the human aspect of it. I think there's always something to write about if there's humans involved, either in the way that they're impacted by a particular environmental story or how they're involved, perhaps as an advocate or a policymaker. You know, to me also, an analogy is when I'm not a very good photographer, but in, you know, pictures that I take, I'd like to make sure that people are in those pictures. I think there are great landscape photographers that don't need people, but I love it. I love writing about people. And that seems to be a common link in all of my stories. We want to make sure that there's a lived experience. And I think that usually makes for a great backstory or a great storyline to help readers become invested in what you're writing about, what you're reporting about.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that human component. And I really see that come through in your reporting, especially your piece that published most recently about the mountain mist mine. You know, that's a story about an environmental issue, but also really told through that human lens.
Yeah, yeah, that was an interesting story to write about. And, you know, I tried to be fair to all sides. It's, you know, mining is an economic activity that we all benefit from. You know, in this case, they're extracting rock that people use on the sides of their homes, on their patios. So it provides jobs. It provides income to many people. It's important to the county, but it also has an impact. And so I think those are interesting stories to write about because this one, I think, when I talk about scaling a story, I think, you know, there are mines all over the state, for one, but there are also other experiences like this one in which some sort of economic activity impacts, you know, a neighborhood or a community or bystanders in some way. And so I think that's just such a universal human problem that we have to sort out. And sometimes we look to policymakers and regulators to fix it, but there are often other really unique solutions to it. So that was sort of the Mountain Mist Mine was a cool way to sort of explore this universal problem of, you know, pollution, how it impacts, how we sort it out, how we deal with it.
Yeah. On a related note, I'm curious about what motivates you to do this reporting. You work full-time as faculty at Warren Wilson College and are raising two teenagers. So what drives you to report on the environment on top of all your other responsibilities?
Well, I love teaching, and I think that's such a natural fit. I love explaining things, and I love working with students. I do see my journalism is really a complement to my teaching or an extension of my teaching, because I feel like one thing I'm doing in the classroom, I teach economics, is I'm trying to break down sometimes complex ideas and not necessarily to simplify them, but to help students in some sort of managed progression understand some difficult concepts and then kind of figure out how to apply it, like to their careers or to their other studies or their hobbies or what matters to them. And I think journalism is kind of the same way. Like, many of our readers don't have the time to sit down and read the forest plan. They need someone who can thoughtfully lay it out to them in an unbiased, or to the extent that's possible, an unbiased way that helps simplify some of these complicated ideas. So it feels like exactly what I'm doing in the classroom, and I just get joy from both of them, and I could bring my journalism into the classroom. And I try and be tricky about this. I don't, but sometimes there's economic theory in my in my journalism too that kind of scares people. That would scare people away if it was too explicit. But
right.
I think that one thing that does complement both economics and journalism is, you know, both of those professions try and approach complex problems from an unbiased perspective. So I feel like I'm, in a sense, I'm almost wearing the same hat. So it's been hard to juggle at times, but it's been really rewarding.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, especially your ability to take these deeply complex issues and make them concise and understandable to a general audience. Like, that's a skill.
Yeah. I don't always do a great job at it. That's also what good editors are for, but
yeah.
Together we get there somehow.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit about news fatigue, especially when it comes to climate and the environment. There's just so much bad news about pollution and species loss and global warming that it can be really difficult to bear witness to so much painful destruction without losing hope. So how do you stay hopeful, and are there any stories you've reported on that have helped you, yeah, stay hopeful, combat that despair?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I mean, that is a real thing. Like, it does feel sometimes to be a little bit overwhelming in kind of the environmental issues that we're dealing with, whether it's, you know, very local to your community, you know, maybe growth perhaps in Asheville or sea level rise on the coast. And yeah, sometimes it does, can seem a little bit hopeless. I think maybe I'm kind of a, you know, glass half or a glass full kind of guy. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
I tend to be pretty optimistic. So I do like to approach stories from a solution, you know, based perspective. Let's talk about some of those solutions. And I think as you get to talk to people who are invested in some of these problems, whether it's sea level rise or forest fires or whatever it might be, usually the people working on them are can be really optimistic. Like, they're thinking about solutions, you know, they're accepting the reality that we have, which is not perfect. It would be far better if we didn't have to deal with climate change. But, you know, that is our reality. And so North Carolina, our state, I think is, there are so many just dynamic people working on these problems, and the opportunity to connect with them in journalism has been, you know, invigorating. Like, you really do get the sense that, all right, there's not a solution to many things, but there are ways that we're figuring out how to adapt, how to become more resilient. And I think those are the stories that hopefully attract people in. I think people want to read. They don't want to, you know, they don't want us to lie about what's happening. But I think stories should, you know, if possible, include some kind of solution component. Like, here's a community, here's another state, here's another country, here's another group of policymakers that are coming up with solutions to adapt to similar problems, and what can we learn from that and build on that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've got a great solutions journalism framework. And just to explain to our listeners, that's solutions journalism is an approach to journalism that centers the possible solutions to a problem instead of only reporting on the problem itself. And I see some of that in what you're saying and also the reporting that you've done. What are your thoughts on framing environmental reporting, not just in terms of issues, but also potential solutions?
Yeah, I think, let me reflect on that for a minute. Repeat the question for me, Lindsay.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you feel about framing environmental reporting, not just in terms of issues, but also potential solutions?
Yeah, I think, you know, any story, you know, is trying to lay out the problem that society is facing. And I think we're, you know, probably not serving our readers as well as we can if we just, you know, put a period at the end of that, at the end of the problem. I think, you know, part of our jobs as journalists is to kind of sort out what are those potential solutions, what matches, you know, the reporting on different environmental problems throughout the state gives us an opportunity to have a fairly unique lens as well. So people who are so immersed in one particular problem, again, whether that's sea level rise or managing Western North Carolina forests, you know, they may not be able to see solutions that are there. Maybe that's something that we can do as journalists, is kind of sort out, oh, you know, I reported on this, and this applies here. Mm-hmm. So I hope that journalists are sort of part of the, you know, sorting through these problems and coming to conclusions that help us, you know, move forward and make our state a better place to live and the environment more resilient to climate change and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really great perspective. I think I tend to agree that I think part of the job of journalists is to offer some insight into potential solutions to problems, not, like you said, just to put a period at the end of the problem, but to also say, here's what this community is doing about something, or here's, you know, what this agency is trying to work through. And I think that solutions journalism is really great, but I don't want to romanticize it too much. There's still a lot of work to be done. Are there any particular initiatives in North Carolina that you're following that are doing the hard work of mitigating climate change and environmental degradation these days?
Yeah, I'm working now on a story sort of on the Central Coast, which I think is really fascinating. Earlier this year in May, there was a really large forest fire in the Croatan National Forest, which is a super unique and interesting ecosystem. And there's, you know, a real connection to climate change there. Longer droughts make things a little more flammable, and this fire got out of control. But there are lots of other super interesting aspects of this story. One is the intense development that's happening around the Croatan National Forest on the Central Coast. If you can picture where New Bern is and Moorhead City, and really all the way down the coast to Wilmington, these are really desirable places to live. People want to be near the North Carolina coast. And that interplay between human beings and managing these natural resources is really super complicated, you know? And so there are a lot of, there's a lot of great work going on right now that involves, one, you know, conserving land on the coast. This is actually an exciting time for land conservationists. It's a hard time because the state is growing, land values are going up, it's really competitive to protect special places, whether it's water or forest. But on the other hand, some of the recent legislation, like the Inflation Reduction Act, has included money for conservation. So they actually have, you know, a few more resources to be able to do some land conservation. So I love this story because it is at the hub, at the intersection of all of these interesting effects that are happening in North Carolina: development, climate change, forest fires, land conservation, sea level rise, water quality, all sort of come together in this story. And again, really great minds working on it. So it's been a fun story to report, but it has big consequences because forest fires are deadly. Forest fires, you know, can potentially harm people through the smoke or through the fire moving into neighborhoods that are near forests. So it's been interesting to see all of the dynamics involved in this problem and trying to figure out how to adapt to it.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to reading that story.
Yeah, coming soon.
Coming soon, great. Well, I feel like in environmental spheres, there's also often a conversation about the importance of making individual choices or the lack of importance of those like individual choices, and conversely the importance of major societal change. So I'm just wondering if you think there are any meaningful differences that we can make by making changes in our own lifestyles as North Carolinians who are concerned about our environment.
Yeah. The problems that we're dealing with are collective action problems. So, Lindsay, if you stopped driving your car and rode your bicycle everywhere, you would certainly make a contribution, you know, to the problem of climate change, but you alone can't solve it, you know. Now, maybe if every single North Carolinian and American started to do that, we'd have an impact, but you know, that would involve major upheavals to our society. These are really complicated problems. I think as an individual, I try and do what I can to be thoughtful about my impact. But I do drive around a lot. I do have, you know, a bigger footprint than probably most people on the planet, as most of us do as Americans. So it is hard, you know, to think about the individual choices that we can make. I think what often helps us make good choices as individuals are sensible and thoughtful policies. You know, as we slowly adapt and transform our society, you and I will have the opportunity to make better choices. I would love to have an electric car right now, but I'm not 100% sure it's practical. I'm not sure I can afford one, but even beyond that, you know, how does it work? How do I drive from one state to the next? You know, the sort of problems that everyone deals with. You know, it's been a really hot July, for example. I'd love to say that I didn't run my air conditioner this month, but I did. It was really hot, you know, and probably we all feel the same way. So I think we do need to improve the individual choices that we make, and I do think we can make a difference, but I also think a lot of that's going to come from, you know, thoughtful policies as individuals, we'll probably have to make trade-offs down the road, and so will our, you know, governments. So it's such a complicated problem without any easy solution ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that as an economist, you're used to kind of thinking about those society-level problems, but also the interplay of, like, individuals within systems.
Yeah, and it also, you know, we also do play around, too, with the moral issues, you know, at play. And that's very complicated, you know, that's very complicated. And, you know, coming from someone who's firmly in the middle class, I probably have more freedom to make harder choices, where people who are living in marginalized communities or people who are just, you know, scraping by, those choices are much more difficult. So I think, you know, climate change is an environmental issue, it's an economic issue, it's also a moral issue of how we sort it out. And that's a tough one. That's such a tough question that what I'm hopeful about is it does seem like in some realms of society we're taking it a little bit more seriously, you know, that we're now starting to see the impacts, you know, a really hot July, for example, bigger storms. I hate it that it would have to come to that, but I could see those forces at play, and I could see, you know, perhaps we're not at that tipping point yet as a society, but we're definitely starting to think about it a lot more, and that, you know, will lead to better solutions, hopefully. Better, you know, more thoughtful innovations that help us out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think personally that one meaningful choice that individuals can make is to be more fully informed about environmental impacts, which is why your reporting is so crucial right now. What kind of impact do you hope that your articles will have on the people who read them?
I feel really satisfied when people better understand these issues, and I try not to be preachy in any way, but in a certain way, I've transformed my understanding of the forest, you know, of, for example, you know, a timber project. You know, I think most people looking at trees that have been cut down is not a pretty sight. I think we have a human reaction to be like, oh, yuck. You know, I much prefer the green canopy to look at. But yet, you know, we need those trees for forest products. Or in some cases, we need to cut those trees for restoration efforts. So they may be exotic species that we don't really need to have there. Maybe we need more diversity in that particular part of the forest. So I hope that, you know, it helps people understand, you know, some, not all, but some of the nuance of these issues. And I think that helps people support, you know, thoughtful policies, maybe not, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for speaking so eloquently about this very dense topic of environmental journalism. What's next for your reporting, Jack?
Well, coming soon is a story about efforts to designate the North Fork of the French Broad River as wild and scenic. It's obviously a branch of the French Broad River. It's in Transylvania County. And there have been efforts in years past to seek this federal designation. Wild and scenic essentially ensures if a portion of a river is designated as wild and scenic, it keeps that river from being dammed into its future. And the North Fork is a really special river. It's very beautiful. This little section is entirely within the Pisgah National Forest. It's very popular among whitewater boaters. It has a relatively high degree of difficulty. But there is right now an effort brewing to look at that designation, which is really complicated. You have to have local support. that local support leads to support from policymakers, including a member of Congress, whether that's a senator or a local congressman. In this case, it would be Chuck Edwards, who would bring a bill to Congress to designate it as wild and scenic and then be signed off on by the president of the United States.
Wow.
There are only five in the entire state, five sections of wild and scenic river. So I think this story kind of fleshes out why folks will be, are interested in doing this. And, you know, if there are, not everyone is supportive of it. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the hurdles involved with that. So that's one story. And then the other story is talking a little bit about the Croatan National Forest and the fire, the aftermath of the fire, and how that ties into recent legislation and how to make that forest more resilient to fires.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to reading both of those articles.
Yay.
So thank you so much for doing this reporting, and thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay.
All right.
All right, folks. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Behind the Byline. We've explored environmental issues from mountain to sea and everything in between. A big shout out to Jack Engelman for his investigative work on the environment in North Carolina. If you haven't read his latest articles about the North Fork River, you can find them on our website, www.carolinapublicpress.org. That's it for our show today, everybody. If you have thoughts to share on the show or ideas for a future episode, please write me at lwilson@carolinapublicpress.org. This is Lindsay Wilson for Behind the Byline. Take care, y'all.